Thanks. I'm going to start by, many of them I'm going to read, but I'm going to start with a few sentences from a sequence of paragraphs in my introduction to the Georgics of Virgil. And I hope that the passages I'll then read will demonstrate what some of these sentences are intended to mean. The first of these is, "It is a nature in which wine no longer flows in the streams, for when Jupiter overthrew his father Saturn, the whole world changed. In Virgil's great myth of the fall of man, it is not through man's own fault, as in the Judeo-Christian myth, but simply because this is how things are and are going to be for all creatures, the hills and seas, the fields, the grain, the cucumbers, the vines, the beasts and birds, the bees, and the creature, man himself. Everywhere in the four books of the poem, there are ecstatic and tender celebrations of the very life in things, and this joy in the very life of things is always, one way or another, coupled with a darker sense. It is a fallen world, and all creatures are vulnerable. The vulnerability of these creatures and what they do and what happens to them is essential to the beauty and value the poem sees in them. Pity is the context for the poem's celebrations. Admiration is the context for the poem's commiserations. It is remarkable how in this great work the triumphs and sufferings of the other creatures than man are fully meaningful and substantiated in themselves. They're never merely background for, nor merely metaphors for, the story of men. The dignity of which they are is never exploited as pathetic fallacy. There is no condescension in the poem towards those others who share our fallen world with us. But if the Georgics is a poem about all vulnerable creatures, it is also, of course, a poem by a human being with his own vital human interests, and the whole truth and intention of the poem is not only what all the creatures of Jupiter's fallen world share together, but the special meaning of this situation for man. The poem is one of the great songs, maybe the greatest we have, of human accomplishment in the difficult circumstances of how things are. You can hear in the poem the pleasure it takes, how proud it feels about what men know, learning how to bring about their precarious successes. There's joy in Virgil's description of the minutiae of tasks well done, but his successes are indeed only precarious and the failures are inevitable. Sometimes catastrophe comes down upon the grain. Much worse has happened and will happen again. There was a plague and all the animals died. Pale Tisiphone rages and heaps up in the stables disgusting, rotting, deliquescent bodies. And men had to scratch at the earth by themselves with harrows and use their own fingernails to dig the holes to plant their seeds in and their own strained necks to drag their creaking wagons up the hills. And because men in Jupiter's disposition of things are vulnerable not only to weather and plague, but to their own natures, there is warfare, brother against brother, threatening to bring down Rome. Over and over, it is as if it all had to be started again. Labor omnia vicit, improbus eduris urgens in rebus egestas, and everything was toil, relentless toil, urged on by need. Culture in the fallen world of Jupiter is always near the fragile beginnings of its making and always near its potential end. Existence itself is fragile in this world, and the more loved because it is so, having to be so carefully and anxiously constructed and maintained by toil and ingenuity and arts. Human culture is always so present and so past, and its future always so uncertain. The poem is haunted by its earliness and lateness. The Georgics is the fundamental poem. I'd like to start with what's in one sense the most important poem in the passage in the poem, although this poem is so marvelously put together that every passage is the most important passage in the poem, and every passage in some sense contains all the others. But this is the one that most explicitly states the conditions of how things are. Father Jupiter himself ordained that the way should not be easy. It was he who first established the art of cultivation, sharpening with their cares the skills of men, forbidding the world he rules to slumber in ease. Before Jove's time, no farmer plowed the earth. It was forbidden to mark out field from field, setting out limits, one from another. Men shared all things together, and earth quite freely yielded the gifts of herself she gave, being unasked. It was Jupiter who put the deadly poison into the fangs of serpents, commanded the wolf to seek and find its prey, ordained that the storm should cause the sea to rise and flood the land, stripped from the leaves of oaks the dew-like honey that made them glisten there, hid fire from man, turned off the flow of wine that everywhere ran in the streams. All this, so want should be the cause of human ingenuity, and ingenuity the cause of arts, finding little by little the way to plant new crops by means of plowing and strike the spark to ignite the hidden fire in veins of flint. Then rivers began to sense that hollow canoes were floating upon their waters. Sailors began to count the stars in the sky and give them names: Pleiades, Hyades, Arctos, starry child of Lycaon. And then they learned to snare wild beasts in traps and feed songbirds with lime. Here one man lashes the river with his line, seeking the depths, and there another drags his dripping fishnet through the ocean waters. Then came the hardness of iron, and then the shriek of the sharp blade of the saw as it made its way, for earlier men used wedges to cleave their wood. Then followed other arts, and everything was toil, relentless toil, urged on by need. The sweetest passages in the poem are often full of a sense of this vulnerability of all creatures and of the achievements that they make, men and other creatures alike, to maintain themselves. This is a passage from the beginning of Book 4 of the Georgics. First of all, find a protected place for the bees to make their home, a place that's safe from the wind, that might prevent them from getting back with their food, and safe from the sheep or the wanton kids that trample the flowers down, or the wandering heifer shaking the dew from the grass and bruising the rising blades. Protect the rich stalls of their honeycombs from the scaly, shiny-backed lizard and from the bee-eater and other birds of the sort, and Procne, whose bloody hands have left their signs upon her crimson breast. Any of these can devastate the bees, catching them in their mouths to carry them home as delicacies to feed to their cruel children. And there should be a limpid spring nearby, or a moss-edged pool, or else a little brook, almost unseen, making its way through the grass, and a big palm tree or oleaster shading the vestibule of the place where the bees have settled. So when the kings of the hive lead the swarm forth in the welcoming season, and glad to be free at last, the youthful bees are capering and playing, there'll be a stream bank or a pond bank there, where they can escape the unaccustomed heat and where the leaves of a tree can shelter them. and whether it's pools or running streams, there must be willow shoots and stones disposed across as resting places for them to spread their wings and dry them in the sun, if any had happened to linger and were caught in a sudden shower, or the wind had suddenly blown them into the water. And there should be sweet, blooming marjoram near, and the odor of serpilla spreading far, and fragrant savory, and violets drinking from the trickling spring or stream. The joy of the poem, as I hear it in the very life of things, and that life of things always in one way and another, in danger in this passage from the weather, in this passage from the heifer or the wanton kids and the sheep, and in this passage also, and the passage also, not just for a liking of mythology, mentions the birds that might threaten them, the bee eater and other birds of the sort, but Procne, and calls into the passage that story of irrational human violence, and this passage and about the little goat. And goats deserve no less than sheep deserve. What they provide, no less than sheep provide. A Milesian fleece, dyed with Tyrian purple, will to be sure be sold for more, and yet the nanny goats produce more offspring and more milk. The more the milk from the udders richly foams in the milking pail, the more it richly flows from the pressed tits at the next milking. The billy goats, gray beards and bristly coats, are clipped to make rough cloth for army camps and jackets for shivering sailors against the cold. When spring comes round again, the goats are able to forage in woods and on the Lycaean heights, feeding on brambles and mountain-loving briar, and they know the way to come home all by themselves, with their kids following after. The she-goat's udders so full that they can scarcely clear the threshold. The more they get along without your help, the more they need the help that you can give them, sheltering them from the wind and from the cold, bringing them twigs to eat for sustenance, and leaving your hay bins open all winter long. And there's this passage, after the rain goes by, you can expect a period of bright sun and cloudless sky, and there are many signs foretelling this. The edges of the lights of the stars at night are sharply defined, and Luna, when she rises, shines with a light so clear it seems it must be all her own, unborrowed from her brothers. No mackerel clouds foretelling rain are seen. No halcyon birds, the favorites of Thetis, are seen on shore, opening wide their wings to catch the warmth of the sun. Nor will you see the filthy pigs in the barnyard using their snouts to toss their straw uneasily about. At such a time, the mists find out the lowest places that they can to spread upon. And as from some high place, the gloomy owl watches the sun go down, her boding song is purposeless and void. Then Nisus, the hawk, high in the cloudless evening sky, pursues his daughter Scylla to take revenge on her for her theft of his lock of hair that lost his city. She flees through the evening air on her little wings. Wherever she goes, her father follows after, implacable, frightful, his wings loudly whirring, and she flees through the evening air on her little wings, and wherever she goes, her father follows after, quieter than it usually is. The hoarse voice of the raven is heard, repeated maybe three or four times over, or high in the trees, among the leaves, you can hear them talking together, in some uncanny way, expressing delight at being home and safe in their sweet nests, along with their young. I do not think this means that they've been granted wisdom by the gods or a special providential power by fate. But when in its changing ways the weather changes and Jupiter Pluvius causes the rain to fall, then causes the sky to clear, then something changes, changes in their minds. Something is different, different in their breasts from what it was when the wind was bringing clouds and bringing rain. That's why the birds are singing and why the lambs look happy in the fields and the ravens are talking. I should say that what you're hearing metrically is, as I hope you notice, is iambic pentameter. I did not try to imitate the Latin verse because I don't know enough, and because Latin is so different from English, and because a 6-foot line is very difficult to handle extensively in English anyway. There are other passages that seem so harmonious and peaceable as to feel almost as if they're out of time itself, or if the universe that the poem is talking about is almost returned to that previous age that never was before Jupiter saw to the new disposition of things. And the context of these passages is always other passages that I started to say undercut or refute that harmoniousness in nature, but they don't do so because these passages are so heartfelt and so generously entered into them themselves, and yet they are never part of the whole context that also contradicts them. It's spring that adorns the woods and groves with leaves. In spring, the soil, desiring seed, is tumid. And then the omnipotent Father God descends in showers from the sky and enters into the joyful bridal body of the earth. His greatness and her greatness in their union, bringing to life the life waiting to live. Birdsong is heard in every secluded thicket, and all the beasts of the field have become aware that love's appointed days have come again. The generous earth is ready to give birth, and the meadows ungirdle for Zephyr's warming breezes. The tender dew is there on everything. The new grass dares entrust itself to the new suns of the new days, and the little tendrils of the young vines have no fear of a south wind coming, nor of a north wind from a stormy sky. The vine brings forth its buds, its leaves unfold. I think it must have been that just such days as these were the shining days when the world was new. Everywhere, it was spring, the whole world over. The east wind held in check its winter winds. The beasts drank in the light of that first dawn. The first men, born of the earth, raised up their heads from the stony ground. The woods were stocked with game, and the first stars came out in the sky above. Nor could the tender plants endure their lot if spring's relief were not to intervene between the heat of summer and winter's cold. And in another such passage, which sounds like the Virgil's first book, the passages in his first book, the Eclogues, which is itself a song about the frailty of human arrangements and natural arrangements is this passage here. But let us eagerly go now, seeking the cool fields where joyful summer, called to do so by zephyrs in the early morning, sends the sheep and goats out to the glades and pastures, when the first star, Lucifer, appears, and the day is new, and the fields are hoary because of the dew that clinging to the tender grass is most pleasing to the flocks. Then later in the morning, when everywhere the querulous cicadas complain in every bush and the flocks are thirsty, I'll take them down to drink from brooks or pools or the wells where water runs through oaken channels to quench their thirst. And after that, at noon, when the day is at its hottest, seek out within somewhere some shady place where Jove's great oak spreads out its giant arms from its ancient trunk, or a grove that lies in a holy darkness caused by the congregated shade of ilex trees. Then lead them in the afternoon back down to drink from those pure, murmuring, trickling waters, and pasture them again till sunset comes, when vesper, the evening star arising, brings its coolness to the air, and the dew that falls from the risen moon refreshes the waiting glades, and the halcyon bird is heard along the shores, and finches in the trees and all the thickets. It isn't far from that passage in the third Georgic, to, and that pastoral scene of the shepherd and his sheep, to this. If you should happen to notice that one of your herd often withdraws by itself to seek the shade, or lagging behind the rest, listlessly crops only the tops of the grass, or sinks down sometimes out in midfield while grazing, or long before nightfall, as if it were nightfall, wanders away towards home, take action with your knife, without delay, before the dire contagion makes its way all through the oblivious herd, a cyclone driving violent winds before it in from the sea is not so swift as the onslaught of the plague suddenly swarming down on the animals, not just one sick, but all of them, all at once, the flock and the hope of the flock, every last one. And the third Georgic ends with a further account of that plague, only part of which I'll. At that time there, they say, men looked for cattle to sacrifice in the rituals of Juno, and there were nowhere any to be found. Ill-matched wild oxen had to be used to pull the chariots up to the goddess's mountain temple, and men had to scratch at the earth by themselves with harrows and use their own fingernails to dig the holes to plant their seeds in, and their own strained necks to drag their creaking wagons up the hills. No treacherous wolf then reconnoitered the sheepfold, nor prowled nocturnally around the flock. His own acute distress had made him tame, and timid does and shy, elusive stags wandered in public where there are dogs and houses, and there were many creatures of the deep whose corpses lay on beaches like the bodies of shipwrecked sailors washed up by the waves, and sea calves fled from the sea to freshwater rivers, and the viper perished, having vainly wound into its winding hiding place to hide, and the hydra too, its astonished scales erect. Nor was the air hospitable to birds. Falling, they left their lives up under the clouds. Nor were there remedies that made things better. The knowledge of those who study remedies, like Chiron, the son of Philyra, or Melampus, the son of Amythaon, only did harm. Led up into the light from the Stygian meadows, pale Tisiphone rages, driving on terror and plague before her, and every day raising up higher and higher her greedy head. The lowing of the cattle and bleating of sheep is endlessly echoed back from waterless rivers, on dry banks and supine hills. And now she brings death to the many and heaps up in the stables, disgusting, rotting, deliquescent bodies, until men have to learn to dig out pits and cover the bodies over and out of sight, for the hides could never be put to use, nor could they ever disinfect the meat by boiling. They couldn't even shear the wool and use it. It was so filthy and so full of the sickness. The cloth would hang untouchable on the loom. If any man should make a garment of it, vile sweat and fever blisters would move across his stinking body, and pretty soon the anthrax, ignis sacer, would have its way with him. And this passage concludes Book 3, and one is meant, I think, to think that of this passage that concludes Book 2 of the poem. The farmer works the soil with his curved plow. This is the work he does, and it sustains his country and his family and his cattle, his worthy bullocks and his herd of cows. No rest from this, but the year will abound with fruits, with newborn livestock, and with Ceres sheaves filling the fields and overflowing the barn. Then winter is coming, the olive press is turning, the pigs come home well fed, made happy by acorns. The woods offer arbutus, and autumn yields all its variety high up on the rocks. The year's vintage mellows in the sunshine. The farmer's simple house is pure and chaste. His children gather around him for his kisses. On the joyful lawn, the little goats fight their battles, butting their horns. The cows' udders are full. It's holiday time for the farmer, at ease on the grass, with a fire going, friends wreathing the wine bowl, he pours a libation. Bacchus, in honor of you. While for the game of darts, some of the shepherds put up a target on a nearby elm, and others of them bare their sturdy limbs, all ready for the rustic wrestling matches. This is what it was like for the Sabines then, and for Romulus and Remus in the old days. This must be how Etruria grew strong, and Rome became the most beautiful thing there is, one single wall surrounding seven hills. Indeed, before the reign began of the king born on the Cretan mountain, and before impious men first feasted on slaughtered bullocks, this is the way it was for golden Saturn, before the time when anyone had heard the loud blare of a military trumpet or the clanging of a sword on the hard anvil. The end of Georgics 2 is meant to make you think of the end of Georgics 3, the end of Georgics 3 of the end of Georgics 2, the end of Georgics 2 and 3 of the end, and especially those last three lines. Before the time when anyone had heard the loud blare of a military trumpet or the clanging of a sword on the hard anvil, to make you hear of the end of Georgics 1. To make you think of the end of Georgics 1 in this passage. The sun gives signs, telling you from what region the wind is to come that blows away the clouds, or what the stormy south is thinking of. And who dares doubt his word? How many times the sun has warned us of dark events to come. Treachery, deceit, clandestine plots, and war. When Caesar's light was quenched, the shining face of the sun, in pity for Rome, was covered with darkness, and that impious generation was in fear that there would thenceforth be eternal night. And not only the sun, but the earth and the sea gave signs, and dogs and birds gave signs of ill to come. How many times have we seen Etna burst, sending forth rocks and whirling balls of flame, pouring her rivers of fire down on the plains? Germany heard across the skies the sound of warfare, and the Alps themselves were shaken. At twilight, in the evening, ghosts were seen, or strange, pale simulacra of human beings. In a silent grove, many attested to this, a loud voice was suddenly heard to speak, and animals, too, were suddenly heard to speak, unspeakable, with voices of men and women. Rivers stopped in their courses. Earth opened up wide. Tears dropped from the eyes of ivory statues in temples. Bronzes broke into sweat. The river Po, the king of rivers, insanely overflowed and with its whirling waters washed away entire uprooted forests and carried off whole herds in their stables together across the plains. At this time, too, menacing threads showed up in the entrails of birds the frightened priests interpret, and blood was in the water drawn up from wells. The ululating howls of wolves were heard, echoing in the streets of high hill towns. Never were there more times when lightning struck down from a perfectly cloudless sky, and never were there more terrible comets to be seen. Therefore, a second time, Philippi saw armies of brother Romans using Roman weapons to clash in war with one another, and the gods above decided it was not unfitting that the Macedonian fields should be nourished with our blood a second time. And someday in those fields, the crooked plow of a farmer laboring there will turn up a spear almost eaten away with rust, or his heavy hoe will bump against an empty helmet, and he'll wonder at the giant bones in that graveyard. That farmer is not the farmer of the end of Georgics 2, but he's like that farmer at the end of Georgics 2. And Georgics 2 intends us to hear the end of Georgics 3, Georgics and Georgics 1 as well. And the end of Georgics 4, I need to read a couple of other sentences from extracted from the introduction to the book. The other creatures in their own ways and degrees have their cultures and their own awarenesses of who and what they are, their own pride, their own loves, their wars, the accomplishments and failures of their labors. But men are unlike the other creatures in having the obligation of learning to know most fully what their labor is, how it succeeds and fails, and in having the obligation of knowing how to sing about it. The Georgics is a fulfillment of that obligation. And in the end, just as in the eclogues, it acknowledges the limitations of what song can do. Orpheus, the greatest singer, out of his very love of Eurydice, vulnerable to his own nature, must lose her as he turns back to her and cannot retrieve her from oblivion. So I'd like to read the end of the fourth Georgic. Eurydice has died because Aristaeus, who had been a farmer and a herdsman and a beekeeper and had lost his stock of bees, had gone to find out from his mother, a water nymph, Tyrene, restitution could come to him. And it was Aristaeus who had, in a sense, caused the death of Eurydice, trying to rape her. He pursued her along a riverbank where a snake was in the grass that bit her foot, and she died and was sent to the underworld. And Orpheus, mourning for her, went down to the underworld to bring her back by means of poetry and music. Then Aristaeus, the old man of the sea, Proteus, who's been forced to tell the story, says to Aristaeus, "It is a god, no less, who persecutes you. The offense for which you are punished, though punished less than what you did deserves, is very great. It's Orpheus, unless fate intervenes, who rouses up these punishments against you, and, inconsolable, rages over the loss of his dear wife Eurydice. She fled from you, headlong along the river, unhappy maiden, and did not see the frightful snake that lurked in the high grass guarding the riverbank. The cries of the sister band of dryads filled the air as high as the mountaintops. The cliffs of Rhodope wept, the cliffs of Pangaea wept, and the warrior land of the Getae, Orithia, Hebrus. Alone upon the unfrequented shore, Orpheus, playing his lyre, sang to himself his songs of you, dear wife, as day came on, with the light of the morning sun, and as the light descended in the evening. Singing he went down through the very throat of Tenerus, the high gate of the dark kingdom of Dis, and through the murky grove where terror dwells in black obscurity, and entered into the Manes place, the place of the dreadful king, and the hearts no human prayers can cause to pity. And set in motion by the sound of music, from the lowest depths of Erebus there came, as numerous as the many hundred birds that, driven there by the coming on of evening or by a winter storm, fly in for shelter in the foliage of a grove, the flittering shades, the unsubstantial phantom shapes of those for whom there is not any light at all, women and men, famous, great-hearted heroes, the life in their hero bodies now defunct, unmarried boys and girls, sons whom their fathers had had to watch being placed on the funeral pyre, and all around them the hideous tangling reeds and the black ooze of Cocytus' swampy waters. Nine times Styx wound its fettering chain around them, and the house of death was spellbound by his music, all the way down to the bottom of Tartarus. Spellbound the snakes in the hair of the Furies, too, and Cerberus, the hell dogs, all three mouths were open-mouthed and silent, forgetting to bark. The wind was still, and Ixion's wheel stopped turning. And now, as he was carefully going back the way he came, and step by step avoiding all possible wrong steps, and step by step Eurydice, whom he was bringing back, unseen, behind his back, was following, for this is what Proserpina had commanded. They were coming very near the upper air, and a sudden madness seized him, madness of love, a madness to be forgiven if hell but knew how to forgive. He stopped in his tracks, and then, just as they were just about to emerge out into the light, suddenly, seized by love, bewildered into heedlessness, alas, his purpose overcome, he turned and looked back at Eurydice. And then and there, his labor was spilled and flowed away like water. The implacable tyrant broke the pact. Three times the pool of Avernus heard the sound of thunder. What was it, she cried. What madness, Orpheus, was it that has destroyed us, you and me? Oh, look, the cruel fates already call me back, and sleep is covering over my swimming eyes. Farewell, I'm being carried off into the vast surrounding dark and reaching out my strengthless hands to you forevermore, alas, not yours. And saying this, like smoke disintegrating into air, she was dispersed away and vanished from his eyes and never saw him again. And he was left clutching at shadows with so much still to say. And the boatman never again would take him across the barrier of the marshy waters of hell. What could he do? His wife twice taken from him. How could he bear it? How could his tears move hell? The Stygian boat has carried her away. And it is said that he, day after day, for 7 months beside the river Streamon, sat underneath a towering cliff and wept and sang and told in song his story. Entranced, the wild beasts listened. Entranced, the oak trees moved closer to hear the song, which was like that of the nightingale in the shade of a poplar tree in mourning for her children who were taken as yet unfledged by a herdsman, hard of heart, who had happened upon the nest. She weeps all night and over repeats her lamentation and fills the listening air with her sad complaint. No thought of marriage or any other love could turn his heart away from his bereavement. Alone he roamed the Hyperborean north and wandered along the snowy banks of the Don or through the barren frozen fields on the sides of Riphaean mountains in grief for his lost wife and Hades' empty promise until the enraged Ciconian Bacchantes in a nocturnal ritual orgy tore his body to pieces and scattered the pieces everywhere, far and wide, and as his head cut off from his beautiful neck was tumbling down the rushing course of Hebrus, his voice and tongue, with his last breath, cried out, Eurydice, oh, poor Eurydice. And the banks of the downward river Hebrus echoed, oh, poor Eurydice, Eurydice. Thanks.